The buggy rumbles over the dirt road as the two occupants sit in silence. Just before her father disappears from the road, the little girl turns around in her seat and looks back at him one last time. The man beside her keeps his focus on the road until they're far enough away, and then he will pounce like the predator he is. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 187, The Murder of Elizabeth Martins. This episode is sponsored by the upcoming release movie, Sharp Corner. When the McCall family move into their new home, they're sure that this will be the family home that makes all their dreams come true. But those dreams quickly turn into nightmares when a tricky section of road right in front of their house starts to claim lives in tragic car accidents. Josh McCall, played by Ben Foster, soon becomes obsessed with saving the lives of these people, and that obsession threatens to pull him and his family into a darkness they may never escape from. Director Jason Buxton expertly crafts some seriously psychologically complex characters in Sharp Corner. Honestly, it's been a long time since I've been a little creeped out just by the energy given off by a character in a trailer for a movie. So this one looks like it's going to be a must-watch. Also starring Kobe Smulders and Gavin Dreher, Sharp Corner launches in cinemas nationwide on the 27th of June. Book your tickets now. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming, and for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You, yes you, are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at truecrimesouthafrica.com/donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Mario Brown, Jessica Card, Vuyo Guma, Cheryl, Jade Grobler, Charlene, Alzette Farr, Priya Govinden, Carla Gerdes-Stewart, and Adele Mankies for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout-out on the pod, and other exclusive content, including Q&As with me, as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Kia ba. This episode was first published in the Patreon feed in April 2023. Today's case is more than a little infuriating for a few different reasons. From the cold-blooded psychopathy of the perpetrator to the extensive delays in our justice system empowering him, there are many reasons why I should not have to be telling you the story of a murdered 11-year-old girl today. But here we are. Another part of this case that angers me is how this man so significantly used the power dynamic which he knew was in his favor to claim his victims. And I can only wonder how many other situations like this play out throughout South Africa on a daily basis. In researching this case, I used an episode of Opsie's Spoor, the judgments in this case, and several media articles. So let's get into episode 187, the murder of Elizabeth Martins.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Leeuwkamka is a town in the Prince Albert municipality of the Western Cape. It falls within the Central Karoo district, and its landscape is very much what you'd expect of the Karoo. Arid, flat for the most part, and with hardy scrub as its vegetation. The town itself is pretty tiny and was formed as a railway town in the 1870s. The town is named for the two rivers that meet where it's situated, the Leeuw River and the Gamka River. Interestingly, both of those words mean the same thing in two different languages. Leeuw means lion in Afrikaans, and Gamka also means lion in a now extinct language spoken by early southern African people called Nkgam. The town itself does not have a bunch going on, and is mainly there to support many of the farms around it. And this is also where most Leeuwkamka residents find work. Many of the farmers in the area farm with livestock, while there are also a few olive farms as well. The Boortus family had lived in the area for many generations. The first Boortus farm was called Weltevrede, and this is where Piet Boortus and his brother grew up with their parents. The Boortus boys grew up knowing that they were going to be farmers like their father, and his father before him. Piet, as the oldest boy, would inherit the Weltevrede farm from his parents, and he grew his property portfolio to include two other farms in the area, De Hoeves and Welgemoed. Weltevrede was, in comparison to other farms, not particularly good to live on. So when Piet met and married his first wife, they lived at De Hoeves. Piet farmed with livestock, mainly sheep, and was well known and well respected in the area. Growing up, as is so often the case on farms like this, Piet spent a lot of time with the farm workers and was often nannied by the female workers, played with their children, and sometimes even ate meals with them. It had to be an odd dynamic, because although these children were all growing up and playing together, there was already a clear distinction in place. Just like Piet had always known he would be a farmer, because that was what his family did, so the boys and girls who were born to the farm workers grew up knowing that this would be their path in life. Many of the children would get no more than a primary school education, and then they would pick up from where their parents had left off on the farm they'd likely lived on their entire lives. This was how it was for Samuel Martins, whose family had worked on and off for the Boortus family for multiple generations. He grew up with Piet. As boys, they ran races along the sandy roads, and then as they grew older, their paths split, and Piet took ownership of his parents' land, and Samuel became his employee. When Piet Boortus was married to his first wife, with whom he'd have two children, Samuel was also living with his wife, Hannah, at the farm. They too would have two children, two little girls, Elizabeth and her youngest sister. But somewhere along the line, things went off track for Samuel, and he ended up in prison. Samuel spent many years away from his family while he was incarcerated, and Hannah raised the girls on her own on the farm, working for the Boortus family. Pete Boertus's first marriage broke down and his wife moved out with their two children. She moved to Wellington, and he would continue to financially support the children, but soon after met and married Sonette Boertus. Around this time, Samuel Martins was released on parole and returned to the farm too. The Martins' children were now old enough to attend school, and their mother Hannah decided she'd rather live closer to the schools and away from her husband, who she'd grown apart from while he'd been in prison. Hannah, Elizabeth and her sister moved to Maverville, 85 kilometres from Leeuwkhamka. Elizabeth and her sister would visit their dad on school holidays and enjoyed spending time with their aunts and cousins who still lived on the Boertus farm. Elizabeth Martins had been described as an intensely shy child. Her aunt said that she didn't really play with other children and preferred to spend time with her mother. Elizabeth spoke so infrequently, they said, that when she did say something, everyone listened because they knew it would be important. Being so close to her mom, Elizabeth found it difficult when they moved to Maverville to visit the farm on school holidays, but she did enjoy spending time with her dad and extended family. She was always happy to go back home, though. In June 2006, the first of several incidents would occur that would tear apart a community and leave both the Boertus and Martins families reeling. In that month, two teenage girls whose mother had known Piet Boertus well and who'd lived on a property adjacent to his farm, De Hoeves, walked into a police station accompanied by their mother. The girls are named in court documents and their mother is named in a media article, but I will not be naming them as they are minors as well as victims of sexual assault. The two girls had a story of horror to tell about a well-known local. The girls said that they'd been collecting firewood on Piet Boertus's farm when he'd appeared and called to them. They knew that they were not supposed to be on Piet's property, but the wood was just lying on the ground, scattered around, and they didn't see any harm in it. But when Piet called them over, they said he was clearly very angry. He made them put down the firewood and told them to follow him to an outbuilding. The girls wondered if he was going to call their parents or maybe even the police to report them for trespassing. But the punishments he had in mind was far worse than anything they could have imagined. In the hours that followed, the girls said Piet Boertus made them strip down naked and then tied each of them to a chair. He then proceeded to sexually assault each girl in front of the other. He ignored their pleading and requests to be released, and soon the girls began to wonder whether he was ever going to let them go. At one point, Piet left them there. It was getting dark outside, and the girls soon started to think that their lives may actually be in danger. One of the girls was able to loosen the ties on her hands slightly, and within a few minutes, she had them free. She untied herself and then her friend, and both girls grabbed their clothes, which Piet Boertus had thrown in a pile in the corner, and ran home, certain that at any moment, Boertus would appear. A case of indecent assault was opened at the Leeuwkhamka police station against Piet Boertus. He was arrested and released on bail. Now, there's not much information available about how the community Piet lived in reacted to this incident. He denied the girl's claims, and his wife believed he was being falsely accused. While I don't know exactly how far the news of this case spread among the community, Leeuwkhamka is a small town, and I cannot believe that there wouldn't be a pretty healthy grapevine in place, as in most other small towns. It seems, though, that for the most part, those that knew Piet, including the people that worked for him, did not want to believe he was guilty of what he was accused of.
And as time went by and nothing further happened around the case, it's likely that people would have started to believe that police didn't have a case against Boortis. What had actually happened, though, which would only be revealed later, was that police had deeply failed the two girls. Their dockets had been misplaced. And it seemed that no one with any authority really seemed to think that it was much of a problem. So Piet Boortis continued on with his life. And those who knew him perhaps convinced themselves it had all been one big misunderstanding. In April 2007, almost a year after Piet Boortis had been accused of some pretty horrendous abuse of his neighbour's daughters, school was out for the Easter break, and Hannah Martens arranged for her daughter Elizabeth to visit her father and the child's aunts on the farm. There she spent several days enjoying the freedom the farm afforded, and although she missed her mum, when it came time for her to go home, the young girl was despondent and told her father she wanted to stay longer. It took a while to convince her that there would be more school holidays coming soon, and she could spend as much time as she liked there then. Unconvinced, but realizing she probably had no choice, Elizabeth packed her suitcase and readied herself for her dad to say it was time to go. Samuel Martens had arranged with his employer, Piet Boortis, that the man would give them a lift to Merveville so that he could drop his daughter off back home. Boortis had some business to do out in the area, so he'd agreed it would be fine for Samuel and Elizabeth to drive along. On the morning of the 13th of April 2007, though, when Samuel and Elizabeth knocked on the door of the Boortis home, Piet told Samuel the plans had changed. He said his wife had decided to go to Merveville with him, so there wouldn't be space for Samuel in the buggy, and he would take Elizabeth back to her mother on her own. Considering Piet was his boss and he was transporting his daughter at no cost, there was no way that Samuel could protest. Even if he'd thought for a minute, it wouldn't be a good idea. But Elizabeth's aunts had later said that even they'd thought absolutely nothing of the scenario when Samuel returned home and explained that Elizabeth was going on her own with the Boortis couple. What Samuel could not know, and what he would only discover much later, was that only two people had gotten into Piet Boortis's buggy that day after he'd said goodbye to his daughter. Piet in the driver's seat and Elizabeth in the passenger seat. Sonette Boortis, Piet's wife, had known nothing of the plan to take Elizabeth back home, and she definitely hadn't accompanied them that day. Later that afternoon, Samuel was surprised to receive a telephone call from Hannah, Elizabeth's mom. She asked when he was going to be dropping Elizabeth off, and he said that Piet Boortis should have dropped the girl off that morning already. He explained that the Boortises had taken Elizabeth back to Merveville for him, but Hannah said the girl had never arrived home. Samuel called Piet Boortis, who confirmed that he'd dropped Elizabeth off. Elizabeth Martens, though, was nowhere to be found. For hours, her mother scoured the streets of Merveville, looking for her daughter, thinking perhaps between being dropped off and actually walking into the house, she'd been distracted and gone off somewhere else. There was no sign of her, though. Samuel waited on tenterhooks at home for any news of his daughter having been found. But by that night, when there was no positive outcome, Hannah called to tell him she was reporting Elizabeth's disappearance to the police. On the evening of the 13th of April 2007, the Merveville Satellite Police Station received a report of a missing child. On hearing that a child had last been seen on a farm outside Lechamka, they referred the missing persons case there. In the days that followed, Piet Boortis was called in for questioning. He told police he'd indeed dropped Elizabeth off in Maverville, but when pressed, admitted he hadn't dropped her off in front of her mother's house as he'd said he had. He claimed he'd been in a hurry to get to a meeting, so he told Elizabeth he was going to drop her off at the school and she could walk to her mom's house, which was not far away. He said he'd figured she made the walk from school to home every day, so she would know the way, and the girl had said that was fine. When police asked whether he had anyone that could confirm this, he suddenly remembered that, yes, he did. His wife. Sonette was in the car with him, and she would confirm that if they asked her. Sonette Huertas did indeed confirm that she'd made the trip to Maverville with her husband, and that they dropped Elizabeth off at the school, and the girl had seemed confident she could make it home from there. Several searches of the Maverville area were made by police in an attempt to locate 11-year-old Elizabeth Martins. Her father Samuel, the family from the farm, and Pitt and Sonette Huertas assisted in the search for the child, but there was absolutely no sign of Elizabeth Martins. In the days, weeks, and then months that followed, the Martins family began to wonder whether they would ever see Elizabeth alive again. And police attention to Elizabeth's case seemed to fizzle to a halt. It's always difficult to know what has happened behind the scenes in cases like this. But police would later be accused of ignoring the fact that Pitt Huertas, the man last seen with a missing child, was also facing charges of indecent assault against two other minors. In a very odd statement, police would later say they'd initially had no leads into Elizabeth's disappearance, and Pitt Huertas had been cooperative and, quote, even helped to search for Elizabeth, end quote. So they hadn't initially had grounds to suspect him. Again, there are probably many things that would never see the light of day in this case, and major overhauls would happen in the police in this area after this case, in the way they dealt with cases involving minor children. But really, this is beyond mind-blowing for all the reasons that I know are currently running through your head too. A man who's been accused of paedophilic acts is the last person seen with an 11-year-old girl before she goes missing. But because he's helped with the search, you don't consider him a suspect. Because no offender in the history of offenders has ever inserted themselves into an investigation, right? Right. April, May, and June would tick by without any movement in Elizabeth's case. The young girl had simply vanished into thin air. As for the indecent assault charges, in June 2007, the case against Pitt Huertas was officially struck off the roll. At the time, the victims were told that there was insufficient evidence to proceed with the case. The truth was, the docket had gone missing. But it may well have been the outrage from this dropped case that had actually sparked what came next. In July 2007, Pitt and Sonette Huertas were called in to the Leeuwkamp police station. They were asked again what had happened on the 13th of April, and they reiterated their story. They were then informed that they were being charged with child abandonment. The police said that the couple had taken responsibility for the safety of Elizabeth Martins when they'd agreed to deliver her to her mother. And when Pitt had refused to allow Samuel to accompany them, he'd taken temporary care of the child. By leaving her outside of the school, as they claimed they'd done, instead of delivering her directly to her mother, they'd essentially abandoned the child, which seemed to have led to her disappearance. Sonette had said that she was also in the car, and police felt they shared equal responsibility. While certainly fair enough charges, it seems that, really, police were finally making some headway in Elizabeth Martin's case, and they were actually using these charges in an attempt to get to the truth. And it worked. As the handcuffs snapped around Sinéad Boortis's wrists, she went ghostly white and asked if she could speak with investigators alone. In the hours that followed, Sinéad Boortis confessed that she had lied. She hadn't been with her husband on the day Elizabeth had disappeared. In fact, they'd had a fight, and she hadn't spoken to him much at all in the days that had followed either. When she heard that Elizabeth had disappeared while in Pitt's care, she said she was furious with her husband for putting himself in that situation. She said he knew very well he already had the outstanding indecent assault charges against him, which she, at that time, did not believe were based in truth. She said that she'd told Pitt that she would say she was with him in the bucky, because she also believed he had dropped Elizabeth off at the school as he said he had, and she could see how the whole situation would look very bad if he didn't have anyone to corroborate his story. And Sinéad was right. It did look very bad, because it was very bad. And although her telling the truth at that point did help get her off the child abandonment charge, she was promptly charged with attempting to defeat the ends of justice and perjury. Then police went to Pitt and asked him if he had anything he wanted to tell them about the disappearance of Elizabeth Martins. He continued to insist he'd left Elizabeth safe and sound outside her school. Investigators told him they did not believe him. They said they believed that Elizabeth had never made it to Maverville, and that she was undoubtedly deceased and possibly buried on one of Pitt's three farms. Pitt declined to comment. Investigators obtained search warrants for all three of Boortis's farms. They decided that the one with the least activity on would be the best possibility to start on, as it would likely be where someone would hide a body if they didn't want people around it the whole day. On the 13th of July, exactly 3 months after Elizabeth Martins had gone missing, SAPS detectives pulled up onto the farm Veltevrede with Pitt Boortis in handcuffs in one of the vehicles. They pulled up next to one of the only structures on the vast piece of land, a collection of disused water tanks, and everyone got out of the vehicles. The officers looked across the endless stretches of farmland and then at Pitt Boortis. One said to him that this was clearly going to be a difficult and very long search, and they'd have him there for the entirety of it if they had to. But if he helped them to narrow down their search area, a judge might look favourably at that later. Boortis stood completely still for a moment, without any expression on his face. Then he turned slightly, made eye contact with one of the officers, and nodded at one of the water tanks. The officer asked if they should start their search there, and Boortis gave a quick nod and then turned away. Next to the water tank that Boortis had indicated lay the skeleton of a sheep, a harbinger of what was to come. The water tanks, from the pictures I've seen, look relatively small. They're about 2 meters wide and maybe as high. There's a round opening on top, about the size of a dinner plate, and the rest of the tank is completely sealed. Investigators peered inside the top, and at the bottom of the tank, identified what they believed to be human remains. The remains were incredibly decomposed, but the size, just from looking at the body, indicated it was very likely a child. In order to preserve the remains, police would have to cut the water tank in half and transport the bottom half to the mortuary with the remains inside. The forensic pathologist could then do the painstaking work of performing an autopsy on the remains in situ, because the minutes they tried to move the body, it would undoubtedly be completely broken apart. In terms of identification, fingerprints were not a possibility at all, and police would soon discover that even DNA was not going to work. The remains had been in the water tank and exposed to high temperatures for so long that the DNA had denatured and was no longer usable. During the search of all Piet Boortis's properties, though, police did find items belonging to Elizabeth Martens. They found a makeshift fireplace not far from the water tank that contained remnants of clothing her aunt would confirm she'd been wearing on the day she went missing. Police also found items from Elizabeth's luggage that Piet had kept in his house, which they believed were trophies. By putting together all of this evidence and the circumstantial evidence that Piet had been the last person seen with Elizabeth, he'd been the one to indicate the tank to them and that the tank was on his property, they and Elizabeth's family were prepared to accept that the remains were indeed that of 11-year-old Elizabeth Martens. Boortis himself would also make certain admissions that confirmed this, although he seemed to want to remain as distanced from the situation as possible, as he was clearly intending on fighting the charges against him. Piet Boortis was charged with the murder of Elizabeth Martens. On the 19th of September 2007, the case was handed over to Captain Kenneth Speed, then of the Provincial Organised Crime Unit. Speed is an incredibly experienced and highly regarded police officer, and he immediately recognised he would need to ensure that this case was handled correctly from then on to make up for what had happened before. Prosecutor Megan Ali was appointed to represent the state in the case against both Piet Boortis and his wife, who was still charged with perjury and defeating the ends of justice. Ali, upon discovering that the ball had been dropped so badly with the first two indecent assault cases, reactivated those cases and gave them to Captain Speed to investigate. By adding these cases to the trial, Ali and Speed hoped to prove that Boortis was a dangerous serial offender and that he should be convicted and sentenced as such. To support this, the then head of the SAPS's investigative psychology unit, Dr. Gerard Labuschagne, was asked to look at the case and present an opinion in court as to the psychological elements of the crime. The trial of Piet Boortis would begin in 2008. He pleaded not guilty to all the charges against him. His wife's trial began separately, and she pled guilty. In her plea explanation, she told the court that she was deeply in love with her husband and had honestly believed he was innocent of the accusations against him. She said she'd never believed for a minute that he'd harmed Elizabeth in any way, but understood that she'd never really known her husband at all. She accepted that her false testimony could easily have led to the abuse and deaths of more children, and she said that she was grateful that this had not happened because she would not have been able to live with herself if it had. Sonette was handed down a suspended sentence, and she divorced Piet shortly afterwards. Piet Boortis' trial would not be nearly as speedy, and it would take another 3 years and several witnesses to get through the charges against him. The two girls Piet was accused of indecently assaulting testified in camera. While the older of the two seemed to be coping better, the younger girl was clearly still deeply traumatized. The girl's primary caregiver had known Piet Boortis growing up, and she testified that the girls had been unable to finish school because they simply could no longer concentrate. They'd received no counselling after the crime, and upon hearing this, Captain Speed committed to ensuring and facilitating professional counselling for the girls. The pathologist who'd performed the autopsy on the remains, later identified as 11-year-old Elizabeth Martins, testified that she'd done over 15,000 autopsies in her career, and close to a third of those had been on children. She felt that she was qualified to determine, through that experience, that even though the remains were very decomposed and the cause of death was impossible to definitively determine, from what she'd seen, there was a very good chance the girl had been strangled to death and that she had been tied up at some point as well. Ropes had been found inside the water tank with the body. The pathologist had found some damage to the hyoid bone in the throat, which pointed to possible strangulation. Although no sexual assault charges were levied against Bertus for Elizabeth's case because of the lack of evidence, the pathologist said that in the vast majority of cases she'd seen where children had been murdered and found naked, they were also sexually assaulted during the murder. It would also emerge that the sheep carcass that had been found next to the water tank had likely been placed there by Piet Bertus in order to mask the stench of death coming from the tank. The prosecutor pointed out that although no one lived on the farm, Piet did visit the land almost every day to tend to his livestock. He also took other farm workers there, including Samuel, Elizabeth's father. The water tank in which he'd left Elizabeth's body was right next to the driveway onto the property. Each time he drove in and out, he would be driving past her body. Dr. Labuschagne would later testify that this was likely done with psychological motive, as it helped him to regularly revisit his crime and, in addition, have the knowledge that he had a secret that no one else knew about. On regular occasions throughout the trial, community members from Leeuwkampke and surrounding towns protested the deep failings of police in this case. At one point, Bertus had to be brought into the courthouse under heavy police guard as the crowd threatened to kill him. Locals demanded complete reform of the policing systems in their area and felt that because Bertus was a well-respected and wealthy member of the community, he'd been treated differently than other criminals, even when charged with the heinous indecent assault charges of the two girls. Eventually, the police commander for the district would address the crowd and promise that significant changes would come from the police failings in this case, which would see changes implemented in the investigation of missing children, as well as police handling of sexual assault cases in the district. While Samuel Martins attended as much of the trial as he could, sadly, Hannah Martins passed away 3 months after her daughter's body was found. She'd been in ill health before that, and her daughter's disappearance, the 3-month search for her, and then the devastating news that her body had been found would all prove too much for her. She left behind her younger daughter, Elizabeth's sister, who had lost her mother and sister in the space of 6 months. Eventually, in March 2010, the trial came to a close, and Piet Bertus was found guilty on all charges. In the sentencing phase of the trial, the state would present evidence through Dr. Gerard Labuschagne in aggravation of sentence, which underpinned that Piet Bertus was undoubtedly a paedophile, and as such, there was very little possibility of rehabilitation. The fact that he'd progressed to murder in such a short space of time after what is his first recorded sexual offence, Labuschagne said, was extremely concerning, and the man should most certainly be considered a dangerous offender. Piet Bertus did not testify in his own defence during his trial, but during the sentencing portion, his lawyer did speak on his behalf, saying that his client maintained his innocence of the charges against him, but oddly, also did not dispute Dr. Labuschagne's findings about paedophilia. In May 2010, Piet Buertus was sentenced to 35 years direct imprisonment. The sentence consisted of 2 8-year sentences for each of indecent assault crimes against the 2 minor girls, as well as 30 years for the murder of Elizabeth Martens. 3 years of the 8-year sentences imposed on the indecent assault charges were ordered to run concurrent with that of the 30-year murder sentence, and 5 years of the imprisonment on each of the indecent assault charges should run concurrently with one another. The judge ordered that the report prepared by Dr. Labuschagne should be placed into Piet Buertus' Department of Correctional Services file, and that his recommendations regarding specialized therapy for sexual offenders, and specifically paedophiles, should be adhered to and his concerns taken into account when Buertus became eligible for parole. Piet Buertus will be eligible for parole in 2030. He will be 62 years old. There is absolutely no doubt that had the case reported by the 2 girls in June 2006 been properly investigated and quickly prosecuted, Elizabeth Martens would not have died. By bungling that investigation, police or prosecutors or whomever was responsible gave Buertus permission to carry on as he pleased. And he did. When they refused to hold him accountable for what he'd done, they may as well have sent him a gold inscribed letter that said, "You, Piet Buertus, can act on your urges with impunity. You and your wishes are far more important than anyone else." And Piet Buertus said, "Well, thank you. That's what I've felt all along." Do I think that those 2 girls were Buertus's first victims? No, I do not. Research shows that most people living with paedophilic tendencies who do act on their urges will do so in adolescence, to some extent. That is not to say that all people living with paedophilia act on their urges that early or at all. In fact, as I've mentioned in other episodes around this topic, it's very likely that we have no idea how many people actually live among us with these tendencies and never act on their urges. Which is why those who do, and those who go on to silence their victims by killing them, are all the more abhorrent, in my opinion. If changes truly were made in the wake of this case in that district, then at least something good came from it. But it really does nothing to reverse the trauma of those 2 victims or the death of Elizabeth Martens. She was a shy girl, and even though she knew Buertus, I'm sure she felt very intimidated alone in his presence. And then we can only guess what happened to her when they drove away from that farm. Or maybe we'd rather not. This case very clearly depicts some common elements in cases of sexual abuse. The perpetrator ingratiated himself into families that had children. This was easy for Buertus, because he was additionally in a position of power, both on his farms and in his community. This also underpins what we already know, but often forget, that strangers are not the problem. It's the people you know that you need to worry about. Because it's those people who will use their closeness to your family and your children and any other weak points they can find or create to take what they want. This also highlights something else that is so common in cases similar to this. The victims not being believed, and those who know the perpetrator refusing to accept that they could have committed such a crime. Sonette Buertus almost got herself prison time because she was so wholly manipulated by her predator husband that she believed he was innocent. Do you think that Samuel Martin's or Elizabeth's aunts would have ever allowed Pete near their child if they thought he was guilty of those assaults? Of course they wouldn't. But people living with secrets like Pete's have been living with them for so long that they've perfected the art of the mask. And it's that mask of normality that makes them so utterly dangerous. Elizabeth Martins, rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Lived Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.